It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. A tornado with wind speeds up to 140 miles per hour ripped through the Fox Valley last week, leaving catastrophic damage to homes and businesses in its wake. As Joe Schultz reports, the community is in the early stages of what's expected to be a long recovery effort.
Menasha resident Chris Silver was working in Sturgeon Bay when an EF3 tornado struck around noon last Monday. His 12-year-old son was still at home. As the storm blew through, Silver raced through debris and down power lines to get back to him. All he could think about was making sure his son was okay.
He hid in the basement. I just got through going under all these electrical wires in my work vehicle to see my kid. How do these other people feel? They were home. Praise the Lord. We're okay.
Silver's home is located in an especially hard-hit neighborhood near Plank Road and Manderfield's Bakery. Silver says it's one of the few on the block that hasn't been ripped to shreds.
I feel absolutely terrible for my neighbors. They're picking through their stuff, their whole lives, everything, their kids' clothes, and it's gone. Our whole neighborhood, it's gone.
As he spoke, Silver looked out on almost unimaginable destruction. Some homes were completely gone. All that was left were scattered piles of lumber, drywall, and insulation. Others were shifted off foundations or left with walls torn away to reveal rooms inside. A neighborhood that had been untouched that morning was now a sea of debris. The National Weather Service says the tornado developed over Appleton around noon and tracked south for 12 miles before dissipating over Lake Winnebago. Menasha and Fox Crossing were the hardest-hit communities. Governor Tony Evers declared a state of emergency and deployed the Wisconsin National Guard. More than 50 service members have been sent to assist in Menasha, Nina, and Fox Crossing. Winnebago County Executive Gordon Hintz made the request.
National Guard exists to help sustain recovery efforts, and so they're really partners in the process.
Dozens of buildings were destroyed, and even more sustained serious damage. Despite the level of destruction, there were no fatalities or serious injuries. In the days immediately after the storm, Menasha Mayor Austin Hammond urged those who do not live in affected areas to stay away.
If you don't need to be in the city of Menasha, please don't. Residents in our community are going through some of the darkest moments of their life right now.
Emergency management officials are conducting damage assessments this week to try to quantify the scale of destruction. That's part of the process of gathering information to make a request for federal disaster relief. Menasha resident Douglas Johnson was visiting his mother in Appleton when the storm hit. He came home to find his house on 3rd Street torn to pieces. The house was leaning off its foundation, the front wall ripped off. Part of the second floor had collapsed.
The whole top of it's gone. Everything else is gone inside. It's like it was gutted out by wind.
Other nearby buildings were completely destroyed. As he spoke, he looked toward what had been his neighbor's home.
You can see it's just one big pile. That was a house.
While Johnson wasn't home when the tornado hit, his dog was.
She crawled underneath the crawl space in my bed, and that's where we found her. She's alive.
Down the street, Wayne Bokelman's home suffered major storm damage as well. He also wasn't home when the tornado ripped through.
I was at work. My wife called and said the house was like a train, and then it got calm, and then she came upstairs, and she said there's just water all over, and part of the roof was gone.
Even though his house was badly damaged, Bokelman says the storm didn't take everything.
What we're doing now is we're just getting some pictures that mean something and some clothes, and we're going to probably stay down by my sister in Oshkosh.
Chris Silver, who drove through the storm to get to his son, was still reeling in the hours after making it home.
I don't care about any of this stuff. That could be replaced. But my family, my community, we need help.
The cleanup is expected to take time, but officials say they've seen a groundswell of support. More than 3,000 volunteers showed up on Saturday alone. Joe Schultz, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is WPR News. Last week, the Wisconsin Department of Health Services announced that more than 60,000 of the 200,000 people enrolled in Badger Care are at risk of losing their insurance at the start of next year. That program provides free or low-cost government health insurance for those with limited income, pregnant women, children, or people with disabilities. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act passed by Congress last year imposes a new work requirement for many people on Medicaid. The state doesn't have work history on file for tens of thousands of people on Wisconsin's version of Medicaid, so if they don't certify their employment, they would lose coverage. Dan Sachs is a professor of risk management and insurance in the Wisconsin School of Business. He joins us to talk about the potential impacts and what people on Badger Care need to know. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We have this change now in Medicaid with the work requirements. In Wisconsin, we're talking about Badger Care. If I have that right, it gets a little twisty, attorney. Who is in danger potentially of losing health care coverage because of this change?
So the work requirements apply to Badger Care members who are childless adults and not disabled, not elderly.
And what kind of proof, or do we know this yet, what kind of proof does that person, again, in that category, have to give to say, hey, I'm meeting those requirements, either through education, work, or volunteer hours?
Yeah, so you need to demonstrate 20 hours a week of community engagement, exactly as you said, through work, education, or some kind of community service. If you're employed and your employer handles your payroll through something like ADP or an automatic processor, very likely the state already knows that you're employed and you won't have to do anything. But if you get paid in cash or you're self-employed or you have a less formal arrangement, you're going to have to demonstrate to DHS, to your caseworker, evidence of your employment. And that could mean showing bank accounts or the deposits. It could mean other paperwork.
And that takes us to the state DHS. The Secretary Kirsten Johnson told reporters last week that Wisconsin currently has no work history for around 63,000 Medicaid recipients. What do you make of that number? Do you expect that's mostly people who are not working or potentially people who just don't have documentation that backs up that they're meeting those requirements?
Well, it's probably a mix of both. I mean, certainly some Medicaid members are sick. All of them, to be eligible, are low income. So many of them, particularly younger ones, may not have any work history at all. But it's definitely true. Many people work in less formal roles with less electronic records that are available to the state.
This goes into effect next year. What are you watching for as states like Wisconsin get ready to get the word out and see if people meet these requirements to help people stay on, or if people aren't eligible, take them off the lists?
Well, one of the big questions right now is how people can establish medical frailty. So the law allows for a medical frailty exemption, meaning if you have a medical frailty, you don't have to work and you don't have to meet these work requirements. States expected that they would be able to certify people as medically frail based on the health records that the Medicaid program already has. But recent rulings from the Trump administration indicated that everyone might need essentially a doctor's note to get a medical frailty exemption. There's a lawsuit going on now challenging that regulation, and I'm paying close attention to how that lawsuit progresses.
So that sounds like potentially a catch-22. I can't afford to go to a doctor. How do I go to a doctor to get this certifying letter that says I have a need to go to a doctor to get this kind of coverage?
Well, it definitely makes it harder to establish medical frailty. But I wouldn't put it quite that extremely, because everyone that we're talking about here has Medicaid, and Medicaid doesn't require any kind of cost sharing to go to the doctor. You might not be able to get a doctor's appointment, but if you can get one, you won't have to pay for it.
Right. But if I'm trying to establish my eligibility for Medicaid, I might not have that free trip to the doctor or the compensated trip to the doctor.
Oh, I see. So most of what we're worried about here is current members losing their eligibility rather than new members establishing eligibility. That's probably going to be a problem going forward, that now there's an additional box you have to check to establish eligibility of either you meet the work requirements or you're medically exempt. I think the state will have to confront that over the next years and beyond. But there's quite a lot of people over the next several months who are going to be subject to these rules as members.
And then that medical frailty question, in some of the reporting I've seen on this, one example was a woman who'd had a cancer diagnosis, an active cancer diagnosis, that would have counted for medical frailty. She'd been through treatment in remission. The concern that she had was, now that I'm in remission, do I still meet that medical frailty requirement, even though I may need further treatment? I might not magically instantly be able to go back to work. Are there going to be, do you expect a lot of gray areas where people might find it difficult to work in their condition but might not meet that medical frailty exemption?
Yeah, I think there certainly will be gray areas. Certainly the law and the regulations that have come out create a lot of ambiguity about what will count. I think it is unambiguous that a doctor's note will count, mm-hmm. but that places a burden on patients and on providers to go and get that note. And anything short of that is potentially ambiguous until kind of we get clarity around how the states can proceed with their medical records.
Now, the whole notion, the whole argument behind the work requirement from supporters is, hey, if people are able-bodied, they're able to work, we want them working and not using this program that is designed for someone else. I don't know how easy it is to put numbers on this. Do we have a sense of how much of current, say, Badger Care recipients or Medicaid recipients nationwide are in that category who would be affected by this?
So like you mentioned, the state has estimated that something like 60,000 members might be at immediate risk of losing coverage because they don't have a work history. You know, from the numbers that I've looked at, something like half of Medicaid members in this category, non-disabled, are not currently working. I would say there's two parts to complying with this. One is actually working. The other is documenting that you're working and convincing the state. And that adds an additional burden, you know, particularly if you're working much of the time. States vary in how easy they make that process. So, you know, states can lean into kind of automatic certification and allowing for multiple modes of certification. So through websites, through visiting the county office, or states can make it really hard and have a hotline that you have to call that's only running for 2 hours a day. Wisconsin seems to be trying to make it easier, as easy as they're allowed to let people certify.
Now, a common concern with meeting requirements such as this is, okay, somebody works in an office 20 hours a week. They're through a payroll provider system. Easy peasy. You can imagine somebody who paints houses, you know, right, with a guy who runs a crew a lot in the summer, less in the winter. They don't have a payroll provider. They may be paid casually or, you know, without a lot of formal documentation. Is there a concern that, hey, this person is technically meeting his requirements and the certification is difficult or impossible to provide?
Absolutely. So I've seen cases where if you're self-employed, especially, there's no one to vouch on your behalf. And then this I'm more familiar with from the SNAP program, the food stamp program. You might have to keep a log of your business activities and show that to your caseworker, essentially, to demonstrate your availability. So it's a lot of tracking.
Talking to Dan Sachs, professor of risk management and insurance in the Wisconsin School of Business, talking about Medicaid work requirements beginning at the start of next year. Over 60,000 Wisconsinites could lose their health coverage, according to recent Wisconsin DHS numbers. Looking away from the individuals receiving this to the system as a whole, if we take probably not all 60,000 people, but a goodly number, thousands of people off of Medicaid, off of Badger Care at once in Wisconsin, what could that mean for the healthcare providers who treat them, who rely on that as part of their income stream, in effect?
Well, there's going to be two kinds of disruption. A lot of preventive and primary care patients won't be getting anymore. That's worse for the patients. And in fact, there's very good evidence that Medicaid coverage like this saves people's lives. It's also disruptive for the providers, as you've said. There's less revenue for them. But the other kind of disruption is that many of these patients will continue to get care, particularly care in the emergency room. Emergency departments have a legal obligation to provide care regardless of ability to pay. What we saw in the last decade plus of Medicaid expansion is that hospitals were having to provide less and less charity care, and they were writing off less and less bad debt because there were more people covered. What many health economists anticipate is that as Medicaid coverage drops, we're going to see a reversal of that trend and likely more uncompensated care, more charity care, more bad debt.
Happening at the same time, we're seeing fewer people enrolling under the Affordable Care Act because of premium increases or the end of premium subsidies, in effect, meaning people have to pay more this year than last year. Do you see that potentially compounding that problem of this uncompensated care at hospitals?
Yeah, it's the same trend that there's fewer and fewer people insured. And I have seen reporting that there's more uncompensated care happening that puts more strain on hospitals. Typically, it's the same hospitals that are serving the Medicaid population and the relatively low income population on the exchanges. As a result, those hospitals are likely going to be in more financial stress.
So looking ahead now to 2027, these changes kick into effect. What will you be watching for as we start to see how many people are losing Badger Care in Wisconsin? How many people are potentially seeking uncompensated care? What are the big question marks for you?
The first question is, exactly as you said, what's going to happen to enrollment in Badger Care? We'll be able to see that probably starting in March or a little later. That'll get reported out. I think a related question is, what's happening to employment, and are people actually responding to these work requirements? And then, you know, a few months after that, I think we'll be interested to see what happens to hospital finances.
Right. What happens to employment? The intent, or the stated intent of rules like this is, hey, we're going to motivate people to go out and get at least that 20 hours of work per week, or education or volunteer. Do we have a track record on the success of that kind of incentive? Does it seem to drive people into the labor market who wouldn't have been otherwise?
There are a couple of states that have implemented early versions of these work requirements. It's not exactly the same set of members that were subject to them. Arkansas is the best studied example, and that was not effective in increasing employment.
Now, another issue for personal costs of medications is or of healthcare is medication. We're seeing some changes from the Trump administration there, an end to some subsidies for insurance companies to provide lower cost medications to seniors. I think I summed that up succinctly. And then down the road, this is a couple years off, anticipated tariffs on generic medications, already some tariffs kicking in on brand name medications. How much does the cost of medication affect people's risk of having to pay a lot for their healthcare and their ability to pay for it?
So medications are an important part of healthcare spending, although not the biggest part. The hospitals are the biggest part. Medications are, for many people on chronic medications, a regular recurring expense. They contribute to the overall premium of health insurance, the cost of medications, and for people who have Medicare Part D plans, which are the area where these subsidies were recently repealed, the entirety of the premium is driven by the cost of the insurers of acquiring drugs.
And finally, on the cost side of healthcare, there's been a lot of questions about, hey, can we lower what we pay for healthcare, what costs are going into it, no matter who's paying, whether it's out of my pocket or my insurers or the federal government or whatever the case may be. Do you have your eye on anything that's going to make the delivery of healthcare more sort of less expensive, regardless of who is writing the checks for it?
Well, much of why healthcare costs so much, why we spend so much on it, is the price of healthcare. We pay much more for things like an MRI or a hospital encounter than many peer nations. And economists believe a key contributing factor to the price of healthcare is the market power of hospitals and hospital systems. So over the last 10, 20 years, there's been a lot of consolidation in the healthcare sector. We've seen more and more kind of mega systems grow. That has surely pushed up the price of healthcare, pushed up premiums that everyone pays. And there's opportunities for antitrust enforcement to push back against some of that. I think that's a key lever available to us.
Dan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Dan Sachs is a professor of risk management and insurance in the Wisconsin School of Business. We talked to them about the new Medicaid work requirements being implemented at the start of next year, when more than 60,000 Wisconsinites could lose their health coverage.